Welcome to Fanboy News Network, your guide to geek culture. I'm Jeff Harris.
And I'm Daniel Christensen.
Well, here we are back another week. We've survived, which we won't go into details, but for some of us, that's a remarkable thing.
Did you keep the receipt? I want your money. You want your money back?
No, we're not gonna go there.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, this is it's been an interesting couple of weeks since we last talked. Nothing major has happened.
Nothing interesting in the oh god, we're all going to die sort of category.
Certainly not. We haven't had any celebrities passing. Well, we've had celebrities passing.
Yes.
Not geek culture celebrity passings. Certainly significant authors.
Yes, well.
But no conventions behaved particularly badly that came across my radar.
You know, by those two standards alone.
Yeah, better than last episode.
Exactly.
So
we're not going to have the throbbing vein on our foreheads of yelling at saying people going, really?
No, probably not. Probably not. I mean, we're going to talk about problematic stuff because this is Fanboy News Network and we go there. So you don't have to.
But hey now,
let's start with film. So I haven't made it to the theater since, well, a couple weeks ago I saw Jungle Book.
Yeah.
And I don't think we talked about it last time. I don't think this has been since we saw. So
are we talking about the white boy stranded in the jungle or the brown boy stranded in the jungle movie?
That's an interesting way to put it because we're kind of going to touch on that.
Okay, good.
Because Tarzan is now out, yes. And I want to see that, and that we're going to have to discuss those tropes with both these movies. So let's start though with Jungle Book.
Okay.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Now this is the Jungle Book live action, and I always do air quotes, even though we're a podcast, because apparently I think that carries through somehow.
This microphone is sensitive enough. It can catch the little whoosh.
Maybe.
Whoosh.
So it's Disney's production, so it is able to directly reference the cartoon. And
Bare Necessities, it has, and Trust in Me. And
it does have those songs in the... It has three songs in the movie.
Cool.
And they're the three you would expect. Bare Necessities, Trust in Me, and Be Like You. Interestingly, Trust Like Me is not actually used during Ka's scene.
Interesting.
It's played as the song over the end credits.
Oh, well.
Well, because they wanted it in the movie, but it really didn't fit the story structure to be in that point.
Well, it's like how when they rebooted Mission Impossible all those many years ago, they had you two cover the original dump, 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 dump,
and
dump, dump.
Sort of. Well, here's the thing. So the animals were CGI. You had a live action Mowgli. They did cast an actor of East Indian descent to play him, which is appropriate since the character is supposed to be Indian.
Yeah, well.
And it is the Indian jungle.
Yes.
And they remember that for the most part, although they play a little loose in one case with animal species. But yeah, they had a great cast for the voices. Scarlett Johansson was Ka.
Oh, right. Yeah, I remember you mentioning this.
And her cover of Trust in Me. So the song went from whatever it was with the original to very much a seductive song.
I think this falls into the shut up and take my money category.
Yeah, it was good. Okay. And then you had Bill Murray as Baloo. And he did his version of Bare Necessities was a lot of fun. They did do a second version of Bare Necessities in the credits done by Dr. John.
Okay.
So that was really well done. And King Louie was Christopher Walken.
All right.
And it was really interesting because they played Louis more as a gangster in this one, an old Chicago gangster.
You dirty rat.
And kind of. And so Walken was kind of doing that, but it was somebody remembering, oh, Christopher Walken is a song and dance man, so let's give him a song because he'll kill it. And he did.
Oh, yeah.
They changed Louis' species because orangutans are not native to the Indian jungle.
Details.
So they did make him an ape species native to the Indian jungle, just one that's been extinct for thousands of years. They made him a giant epithecus.
Okay. Gesundheit.
Although it did make me so they could play with him being very large too. With Blue, they called him a sloth bear, which is the correct species of bear for that region, but they presented him as a brown bear. Although I like the fact that several scenes in the movie that they remembered Baloo is, in fact, a bear. They had a whole bunch of monkeys attacking him, and him largely not caring because he's a bear.
Well, I was going to say he was a bear, and they're in the woods, so I was a little worried there for a minute.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, the monkeys should have worried about that. But no,
more to fling. Oh,
overall, Idris Elba as Shere Khan.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Kingsley was in it as Bengar, the panther, and
it's the mouse. They have no shortage of talented people.
No, and it was Jon Favreau as the director. It was really good. I really enjoyed it. I was surprised how much I enjoyed it. So yeah, it was a time well spent. And there were previews when we went to it for the new Tarzan movie.
Go figure. They're hyping the heck out of it.
And it looks good. The thing I've heard, and reason I'd like to see the new Tarzan, is I have heard this is the one that adheres the most closely to what Edgar Rice Burroughs wrote.
That is, and we're billing that as a good thing.
They've never done it. Well, they've gotten close to it a couple of times. They him, they ha. I've just always wanted to see that presentation of Tarzan. We've gotten so used to Johnny Weissmuller.
True.
And the me Tarzan, you Jane, as opposed to the really intelligent, articulate Tarzan from the books.
Right.
So, and Alexander Skarsgård has a great look for playing Tarzan.
That is a remarkably nice way of putting it.
But, and this is where we get into some of the issues, because some people have already been bringing up, we've hit a point in society where when people are reviewing the movie, they can't get away now from the fact that it comes from a horribly problematic trope.
Well, it comes from a horribly problematic time frame.
Well, and that's part of what people are saying. It is definitely a product of its time. But it's one of those things that it's like when we were discussing H.P. Lovecraft a few episodes ago.
Yes.
And it's being able to enjoy something while acknowledging its problematic aspects.
Well, and being able to enjoy it and be able to critique it and say, really? You know, being able to hold it up to the light and say, yeah, see that? That's racist as all get out.
Well, and this goes back to when we were talking about the Iron Fist series coming out. Mm-hmm. And you were thinking it was whitewashing. And it turned out, no, it's a different problematic trope. It's the white savior. In the comics, he was also white. And it's the same thing. Tarzan is the progenitor of the white savior archetype. The white person introduced into a non-white culture and ending up becoming its greatest hero.
See also John Carter of Mars. See also Daenerys Targaryen. See also...
Yeah. Basically. It's a very common trope, and Burroughs basically codified a lot of it.
It was Victorian England. I would expect no less.
So I do want to see Tarzan. I probably am going to see it relatively soon. I'm just acknowledging the trope exists. I'm not ignorant of it.
Yeah.
I hopefully can shut it off enough to enjoy the film. Again, much like... again, I can read Lovecraft.
Yeah.
And although the problem is once you realize how racist he is, it becomes glaring in his work.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, it's just that's a thing. Speaking of being able to enjoy something despite its problematic origins.
Okay. That's a heck of a lead-in.
It is a heck of a lead-in. So, as part of my regular Friday night horror movie viewings with the Don't Read the Latin crowd.
Yes. Shout out to Jennifer and Michael.
Yeah. This last week's offering was The Conjuring. And here's the thing about The Conjuring. It is a expertly made horror movie. The director, I believe it's James Wan, is the original Saw movies. He did the Insidious movies. He's a very good horror director. He understands how to build tension, when exactly to release it, and The Conjuring is... I hear The Conjuring 2 is just as good, although it has sequelitis, it ramps things up. Okay. But The Conjuring was just this expertly made horror movie. It was so scary that when they put it before the motion picture rating board, they gave it an R. And they told the director flat out, there is nothing you can cut that will reduce the rating because you didn't have overt sex, you didn't have nudity, minimal swearing, minimal blood, but this movie is so frightening we cannot give it anything less than an R. Which on one level is a great compliment to a horror director.
It
Congratulations. You've made a very scary movie. And scary enough that it was the third time Jennifer Lovely had seen it. She still shrieked at one point. It's that good, a horror movie. But the problematic part of it is touted as a true story. And that is because it is taken directly from the files of a pair of paranormal investigators from the 60s and 70s named Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Okay. Slight pause, and just so, because I needed some clarification on this when we discussed it earlier. When you say paranormal investigator, you mean the sort with the special equipment they're going out and trying to hear ghost farts, as opposed to people like James Randi.
Exactly.
Okay.
And they gained prominence for being the investigators of the Amityville Horror. And they did several investigations that were prominent. There's a famous one. In fact, it's referenced in The Conjuring about a demon-possessed doll called Annabelle. That it's famous because in their storeroom slash paranormal museum in their house, Annabelle is in a glass case surrounded by religious artifacts with a sign, "Do not open under any circumstance."
Isn't there one of those in Ankh-Morpork University as well? University?
And that is probably a direct reference.
Yeah.
But the thing with Ed and Lorraine Warren are based on most... So this is going to be the allegedly, just for... in case anyone hears the show that... It's pretty clear that they were most likely hucksters. They were.
Is there any doubt in your mind? I mean,
well, it's on that very slight benefit of a doubt. People who have re-examined the evidence of the Amityville Horror, there's plenty of evidence that was a hoax. The real family that The Conjuring is based on, although they do claim their house was haunted, they stayed there for 10 years and they certainly didn't get much help past an initial investigation from the Warrens. There's another movie based on one of their investigations called A Haunting in Connecticut. They did a lot of different investigations. His claim was that he was a renowned demonologist, the only one that was not a member of the Catholic hierarchy. And Lorraine was a clairvoyant.
Of course she was. Yeah, now, I'm sorry. So Reader's Digest condensed version, you have two con artists who go around taking money from people, and this is one of their stories.
Right.
Okay.
But in the movie, they are presented as paragons of virtue.
Of course.
They are fantastic people, and they're played by great actors. Patrick Wilson and, I always mispronounce her name, Vera Farmiga. She plays Norma Bates on Bates Motel, the Psycho prequel series. She's a great actress. He's a great actor. He was Night Owl in The Watchmen.
Okay.
He was actually the lead of the Insidious series, which was one's previous horror series. He did another great horror movie I saw recently, Bone Tomahawk, with Kurt Russell. He's a fantastic actor. Ron Livingston played the father of the family. Lily Taylor played the mother. Just great cast, well acted, just expertly executed film. Everything about this film to admire. I enjoyed myself thoroughly. But there's always that little voice in the back of my head based on an actual lie.
Okay, yes.
And again, it's that being able to enjoy something while acknowledging this is problematic as hell.
Well, yes.
And I hear, and Jen and Michael have seen it and said The Conjuring 2 is just as great. It just suffers a little bit from sequelitis ramp up, but not too badly. So I want to see it too, if it's that good. And I guess the studio's like, no, let's keep making more movies about this. You know, there's plenty of Warren investigations to fill an entire movie series.
Oh.
But at some point, somebody's going to have to step forward and go, and this is who... Well, the problem is Lorraine is still alive. Ed has passed, but Lorraine is still active. In fact, was a consultant on the film. So I think people are very leery of just coming full on and saying no, just because of that.
Because she can still hire lawyers.
Yeah, basically.
And revoke the right to use her name.
Yeah. So, anyway, so great horror movie. Highly recommend it. Just keep that in mind. With that, what else? Oh, well, TV.
Two for two here. Sorry, go on.
Well, and you know, there's not been much on. I've been watching Preacher. We talked about it last time. It's still just an absolutely fascinating examination of how you adapt from one medium to another. In fact, people have been asking me about that because, as we proved last episode, my level of comic nerddom is epic.
Deep and strong.
And so people were asking, so how does it compare? And I always have to preface with, I think the show's great, but it is both very much like and yet so very different from the source material. But in ways that make sense for what they're trying to do.
Right.
You know, they're trying to still tell the Preacher story within the confines of a TV show. And I still applaud their efforts. They're doing a great job. I'm engaged in the story. But characters are coming together in different ways from the comic book because they have to.
Yeah.
Plus, I mean, if you were to do Preacher the way it was presented in the comics, it would have to be an HBO miniseries or an HBO series that would make Game of Thrones blush.
Nice way of putting it.
So, speaking of Game of Thrones, so I know spoiled as all hell.
I was going to say, there's no such thing as spoilers at this point because for whatever reason, all the restraints came off with season 6. Yeah. Have at.
Although the thing I heard is, so they had a good season and were well received. They have to delay season 7 because winter only lasts so long in the real world and they need winter film scenes to make the season work.
Details.
So they've got part of it filmed, but they have to wait till next winter to film the rest. If
they're making enough money, I'm surprised they don't just charter a jet and go to Antarctica.
You know, you wonder, but but that's that. Other than that, I haven't heard too much about recently, other than American Gods is still looking like,
oh my,
it's going to be just phenomenal.
Well, I have to say it was entertaining because they just recently announced Gillian Anderson as being media.
Yeah.
Which I think is amazing. But somebody dug up this photo shoot that she had done like 2-3 years ago of her done up as Lucille Ball.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's like, do you think this is going to be the new stills? And I was, no, it's 2-3 years old. It's an easy Google search. But
it proves.
Yes. But the thing that got me, though, is that Gillian Anderson herself released a picture. And all you see in the foreground is a woman's hand holding a remote. But it's a very finely manicured hand with blood red fingernails. And in the background, you see this very blonde hair and a white dress. And I'm like, they could be playing Marilyn just as easy as they could be playing Lucy.
Well, again, they're going to have to adapt their media.
Yeah.
From book to TV. The thing is, in this case, you've got Brian Fuller at the helm. And we've seen what he can do. We talked about it last time we talked about the show with what he did on Hannibal. He's bringing a lot of his... Again, he's got the actors he likes that he brings from show to show. He always recasts people because he gets people he knows how to work with. Gillian Anderson is a great example. But then he worked with Orlando Jones before. And Orlando Jones may be the second most important casting they've done behind Shadow and Wednesday. Because they cast him as Mr. Nancy.
Which is going to be lovely.
And it's just like, oh, well, just, you know, if you need any of my money, let me know.
Yeah.
Because I'll be right here for you. I mean, there's few people I would trust with something like American Gods, but Brian Fuller is one of them. Yeah.
And with Orlando Jones, I mean, I'm kind of retroactively going back and kicking myself a little bit because I had the opportunity to see him at Emerald City Comic Con. Because back then he didn't have a line in front of his table, but you know now I think he might.
Well, and he's a gift to any production he's in because once he's in something, he is full throttle, and he is active on social media and will bring people to the show just on his fan interactions, which is just that's great. I think everything I've seen about American Gods makes me happy. And of course I hope I'm not setting myself for a great letdown, but considering who's involved, I don't think I am.
Well, the thing that I have learned is that there has to be a strong tempering, because I mean, I remember as far back as when Deathly Hallows was first coming out, mm-hmm. and I mean the book version, not the the movie version, and I remember a comic to the effect of, "So do you love it or do you hate it?" And they're like, "It hasn't come out yet. We don't know." He's like, "No, either you are enough of a geek that you have a completely preconceived notion of exactly how everything is going to happen, and anything else is heresy, or you just love it and will love it no matter what it is, because you're a fan of the series. So do you love it or you hate it?" And everyone's like, "Well, thank you, for raining on the parade." But in some senses, you have to temper that. You have to keep in mind that this is dealing with stuff beyond our ken. We enjoy the stories, but all the voodoo that goes into making those stories, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's...
I mean, look at Game of Thrones. It's one of the most popular things that HBO has ever done, that television, frankly, has ever done. And yet... there are a lot of people that have a lot of issues with it because problematic.
Well, and what was it when I was talking recently with Jennifer Lovely?
Yeah.
One of the things she pointed out is, she has followed Game of Thrones. She has followed Walking Dead. Her problem with both shows is they seem to actively hate their audience.
That is a nice way of putting it. I would simply say that it's taking the grim dark to the next possible level.
Actually, Michael had a great suggestion of a story he wants to see sometime. And I was like, I don't know how you'd ever get it produced, but it's a great idea. Do a TV show where things already start out pretty horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And each season, things get a little bit brighter. Each season, things get a little bit better and a little bit nicer, and things start going better for people. And I'm like, so that's just... you sit in a corner and think about what you've done, young man.
Yes.
But it's a great concept.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you pull it off, but it's a great concept.
Worked for Leave It for Beaver for how many seasons?
I don't know if you can quite count that. But that just makes me think about Pleasantville.
Oh, yes.
Other than that, I know that Supergirl, in preparation for its moving to CW... season one of Supergirl will show on CW over the summer.
Oh, cool.
Which, it's a nice way to do the transition. I've heard there's an effort going to try and do a third season of Gallivant somehow through a different media. I'm assuming they mean web somehow, but...
Netflix.
Maybe. They certainly could pull it off. Netflix has right now done some amazing work.
Otherwise, bets on there being an actual cancellation bear at the end of season two.
Oh, wow. That would be interesting. That was still a funny joke.
Yes.
So that's all I really know on TV right now. Moving over to the world of comic books. So last episode, you got rather impassioned.
I feel very strongly about this.
And it was about the Hydra cap.
Yes.
And... so here's the thing. Those of us who have been fans for years knew, okay, there's no way they're going to leave Cap like this, because the next time Chris Evans shows up on screen, they're going to need Steve Rogers to be a hero again. But what you had was Tom Beveru, the executive editor at Marvel, and Nick Spencer, the writer, both going, nope, this is not a hoax. This is not mind control. This is how it has always been. And yet the issue that just came out showed exactly how it is mind control and time manipulation through a cosmic cube by the Red Skull to retroactively make Cap a Hydra agent. In other words, it's all of the above. And at this point, I know you had that great line from Bob's Burger.
It's not a twist. It's a lie.
Yeah. And at this point, it's like...
ooh, that's the first time I've maxed out your
register. That is not the first time you've maxed out the register. It's just the first time you've noticed it.
This time.
No, it's not even true. Okay. But I actually watched the...
oh, yeah.
Because that's also how I keep track of the time. But the... it's Tom Beveru. If he ever swears up and down anything again, all he has to do is go Hydra Cap.
Yeah.
The man clearly doesn't care. Of course, what was pointed out to me was... you know what? yeah, all of us knew that, but the damage is done because major media is not covering the second issue reveal. They just cover the Captain America revealed to be Nazi.
Yeah. Well, and it's well, part of that is major media will always cover the big lie. They never cover the retraction afterwards.
Yeah.
But I was talking with my wife about it the other night, and one of the things she pointed out is this is one of the problems with not creating new stories, without creating new heroes. Mm-hmm. If you have, I mean, Captain America came out in the 30s.
Yeah.
You know, late 30s, early 40s, during the war effort. Go figure. It's been out for 70 years.
75?
Yeah.
75. This year is the 75th. In fact, they're counting this just past 4th of July as Captain America's 75th birthday.
Yeah. Now he can get a discount at AARP membership. But seriously... Okay, so let's go back to your tropes discussion from earlier.
Sure.
If you have a set number of characters,
mm-hmm.
and there are X number of tropes out there,
mm-hmm.
how long before you start getting out of your character's little box and getting into things where it's like, oh no, it's Hydra Cap. Oh no, it's Batman versus Superman. Oh no, it's blah, 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 blah. Which... really shake up the idea of what that character is all about. If you have new characters, this one can go off and explore X stuff, and this other character can go off and explore Y stuff. You don't have to have one person trying to experience the whole alphabet worth of tropes.
And you do get that to certain degrees, although you get a lot of it through pastiche characters.
Yeah.
One that comes to mind, there's a great comic writer named Mark Waid.
Okay.
Phenomenal comic writer, and he wrote a comic series called Irredeemable, which the premise is superhero universe, and the Superman XP of that universe decides screw it and goes on a rampage and basically goes to take over the world, and is and the irredeemable part is he goes way far. And of course, it explains what led up to this. What psychological pressures caused that hero to break. And its companion series was called Incorruptible. About the big supervillain of that universe who, upon seeing what happened to the hero, goes, well, somebody's got to stop him. and so they flip.
Yeah.
And it's a really great examination of the tropes using XP characters,
define XP for XP those. XP is
again, it's a character standing in for another character. So I think it's called the Plutonian in Irredeemable, is an XP for Superman.
And the difference between an XP and a pastiche?
A pastiche is very, Plutonian is probably both. A pastiche is very much, oh, this character was clearly based on Superman, or the Watchmen characters were clearly based on the Charleston characters. Where an XP is, okay, this character is taking a place in the story that would be held by this character without necessarily being directly based on that character.
Okay.
But the thing is, holding a place, that means a lot of pastiches can still be XPs. But in Irredeemable, it was very much obviously a pastiche.
Okay.
And you know, and I'm a sucker for a good pastiche character if they're done well, because it does allow you to examine the characters without necessarily being weighed down by all their expectations in history.
And canon, you know, 75 years worth of canon.
Oh yeah. So, you have tons of pastiche character. You pick a major character and I can pull up their pastiches. There's a great Lord Graneth character created by Philip Jose Farmer, who is a pastiche for Tarzan.
Sure.
Because he wanted to write a Tarzan story back when rights was an issue. That's a lot of time for you. There's a great character named Solar Pons, who is a pastiche of Sherlock Holmes They came out around the same time the Sherlock Holmes stories themselves were coming out. Great character, great history, well worth, and another character very similar, Sexton Blake. And these characters are great, and they have their own great histories, even though they're based on other characters. So, you know, a pastiche is not necessarily a negative, because Watchmen were pastiches, and they're more well-regarded than the characters they're based on.
See, it's funny, because you mentioned Charleston characters, and when I see Watchmen, I see it far more based off of the grand pantheon of DC Hall of Justice.
Well, and a lot of people do, because what happened... All right, so digging into my vast nerd knowledge, Charleston was a comic company that went kaput many moons ago, and DC managed to buy their catalog and get their characters, and had initially introduced them in the original Crisis on Infinite Earths. And so the characters that were the Charleston characters were the Blue Beetle, the Question, Captain Atom, Nightshade, Peacemaker, and they went to Alan Moore and said, do you want to do something with these characters? And what he turned in was Watchmen. And DC came back and went, Alan, we wanted to use these characters afterwards.
He's like, you didn't tell me that beforehand.
And so what he did is he just went back and retooled his stories, changing the Charleston characters into... So Captain Atom becomes Dr. Manhattan. Blue Beetle becomes Night Owl. The Question becomes Rorschach. Nightshade becomes Silk Spectre. Peacemaker becomes the Comedian. It's, you know, it just... Judo Master becomes Ozymandias. It's, you know, these were very directly based on Charleston characters. However, the Charleston characters themselves were great hero archetypes. I mean, Captain Atom was effectively the Superman for the Charleston universe. Blue Beetle was effectively the Batman.
Yep.
Well, with the Question holding... Question is a weird one because he was created by Steve Ditko, so there's a whole objectivist history to the character that really informed Rorschach. Those characters... The thing is, people are far more familiar with Rorschach than they are the Question.
Of course.
And so that, like I said, pastiches aren't a bad thing. They just, it's fun when you know. I honestly, looking up some of these characters sometimes, I try and track down stories. I still want to track down some Sexton Blake and Solar Pond stories just because I want to read them, because knowing their histories, there's a Sexton Blake character called Monsieur Zenith, who was a supervillain because he suffered from great ennui. And no.
Which is why his name's French.
Yeah, but the thing with him was, only by doing these master criminal activities did he get the contest. Sure. Against Blake was the only thing that engaged him in life. And the catch with Zenith is, he didn't care if he won or lost. He was just as happy losing as winning. Because all he cared about was
playing the game.
That character ended up becoming one of the major influences on Elrond. No, I'm saying it wrong. There's a character. I'm probably getting it wrong now.
Who?
Hang on. Sorry, Elric.
Ah,
not Elrond. Elric.
Michael Moorcock.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So Monsieur Zenith, because he was also an albino. Because again, problematic tropes. A villain created for a pastiche hero got his own pastiche that became far, you know. And it's, you know, where do writers take inspiration? They take inspiration from reading.
I remember reading somewhere that the art of creativity is being able to disguise your sources.
Yeah. Great, you know, good writers borrow from other writers, great writers steal outright.
Exactly.
So, yeah, so that's, you know, it's, honestly, I would recommend looking into these things to anyone. Mm-hmm. It can be fascinating. Just the research about these characters' existence. There's a book, Myths of the Modern Age. I forget the name of the author, but it's about Philip Jose Farmer's Wold Newton family, where
love to death.
I love to death, but the thing is, I didn't know many of these characters existed until I started reading about the Wold Newton family, because they take the pastiche characters and bring them in just as much as the original characters. And that's where you start learning, okay, there's this character Sexton Blake, I should be reading about him. So yeah, it's that's my 2 cents worth on that.
So you're talking about the Sexton Blake and the Solar Pond as being knockoffs, for lack of a better term,
yeah,
of
Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes. Finally got to see Ian McKellen's Mr. Holmes. Have you seen that?
I have not seen it yet. I really want to.
It's fascinating. It's in some ways it's more meditation on getting old,
mm-hmm,
and mortality, but at the same time, I love Ian McKellen. Yeah. I will watch that man read the phone book. He is a remarkable actor in so many ways. This was an odd movie. It was good. I'm glad I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
But it does end up treating it a little strangely. So
yeah, Sherlock Holmes. Well, here's the thing with Sherlock Holmes. As a longtime fan of the character, having read many of the original stories, one of the important things to remember is Doyle didn't care. Doyle didn't even like Sherlock Holmes. He wrote Sherlock Holmes stories because they paid the bills.
Yep.
And he held some embarrassment that his great fame came from this character, despite the fact that the character is a cultural icon.
Yeah.
What that meant was, when people were doing knockoffs of Sherlock Holmes, Doyle's attitude was, go for it.
Yeah, have at it.
You want to do actual Sherlock Holmes stories? Feel free.
Yeah.
He didn't care. And, Sherlock Holmes being in public domain almost is somewhat of a disappointment, because that means people can't come up with clever pastiches of the character, although they still manage to.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, House was a TV show that went on for 7 or 8 years.
Oh, yeah.
And was directly based on Sherlock Holmes.
But at the same time, you even just look at the difference between Robert Downey Jr.'s Sherlock Holmes,
mm-hmm,
Benedict Cumberbatch's Sherlock Holmes,
mm-hmm,
and I don't even know the guy's name, but the Elementary crew.
Oh, Johnny Lee Miller.
Sure. I mean, you want to talk apples, oysters, and doorknobs. I mean, that's three remarkably different interpretations of the same.
I think, that shows the strength of a character.
Mm-hmm.
When a character can have that many interpretations and have them be solid like that, that shows a solid character. It's like, I've always had an opinion of cover songs.
Yeah.
You know, a song's really good if, you know, a lot of different covers can be done in different styles, because the root of the song,
yeah,
is strong. I was recently sharing with my wife artist I discovered several years ago named Richard Thompson,
okay,
who is a songwriter and guitarist and singer from Britain, who over 20 years, he's always sort of been on the edge of fame, but for musicians, he's a huge influence. And he's got a song that is gut-wrenching. It's great, but it's gut-wrenchingly good, called 1952 Vincent Black Lightning. Yeah, it's a song about a motorcycle, but it's a beautiful song. And it has been covered as country, bluegrass, rock. The song itself is so solid, and the narrative is so solid. It's easily adaptable. Another great example is Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah.
Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. You look at Bach. And we pause to reemphasize Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower.
Yeah.
So
I guess the point is, like certain songs, certain characters, if they're strong enough, you can have multiple interpretations. Now, some characters don't lend themselves well to that interpretation due to aspects. It's Superman. People try and reinterpret all the time as different things. They don't always work, because there's a core to the character that you need to stay true to. And that seems to be where people have problems versus Sherlock Holmes, where, you know, even in the books, he's a hot mess. So you get a lot more to play with.
True. True, true. Well, and you talk about not recognizing the core. It reminds me of the story that came out of the Lord of the Rings movies, of the original man that they had cast to play Aragorn,
mm-hmm,
whose name escapes me off the top of my head.
Stuart Townsend.
Gesundheit. He was there. They started filming. He was getting into it. But he couldn't understand why Aragorn didn't just take the ring from Frodo. And they worked with him, and they worked with him, and they worked with him, and he still couldn't get why he didn't just do that. And that's why we now have Viggo Mortensen.
Although that's not the official story.
Yes, of course. And yet,
But even the official story, Jackson decided, no, you're really too young to play the character. Yeah, but that's, you know, that is how much are you adhering versus veering from a character. I bet you look, you know what, Aragorn is another archetype.
Oh, yeah.
You see reinterpreted many times. So that's, well, that was my cat. We won't get into that. I'm just saying there's, studying pastiches can be a great pastime just because you start seeing the different ways. There's a couple of pastiches out there of Doc Savage.
Of course.
That are fascinating to read, where it's a chance to look at that character type through different lenses. I mean, I consider Buckaroo Banzai a pastiche of Doc Savage.
See, the thing that I find amusing is that people are starting to dig further and further back and mm-hmm. go through all these little nooks and crannies. A, we're still stuck in England and America.
Yeah.
And not bothering to look at the entire rest of the world worth of stuff. But also, at this point, you walk up to the average Joe Schmo on the street, you say Doc Savage, they say who, you say Buckaroo Banzai, and you might get more of a glimmer. But it's that thing of where the, what you were talking about before, with the idea of the new interpretations, Gary, taking on a greater life than some of the originals.
Yeah, that's true. So kind of a long way to go from the Hydra Cap thing. The thing is, there elsewhere in the comics industry, because we were originally talking about comics.
Sure.
You were kind of rolling back to something you'd said earlier about, you know, these set characters and where do you go with them. There are some great characters being created.
True.
Out there. There's some great books. Saga and Wicked and the Divine come to mind if you're really interested, especially for writers who care about their characters. Wicked and the Divine, I haven't gotten a lot into yet.
Which, say that slower.
What?
The name of it?
The Wicked and the Divine.
The Wicked and the Divine.
By Kieran Gillian.
Okay.
Who is the author of Darth Vader.
Okay.
The Darth Vader comic. And it deals with mythology. But borrowing from existing mythos, but creating new characters out of it. Saga is going straight up new characters. Saga is a little mind trippy, but well written.
There's nothing wrong with a little mind trippy.
And even then you've got Lock and Key by Joe Hill. And here's the one that I think it's interesting. You know, man became a well-regarded rock star so he could become a comic book writer. Gerard Way's Umbrella Academy.
Okay.
He's the lead singer and songwriter of My Chemical Romance.
Outstanding.
So, I mean, there's some... The comic industry has a lot of creativity in it. And there's a lot of great stuff out there that sometimes just gets overshadowed. Sometimes gets overshadowed by the big two, by the classic characters from bygone eras, just because they're what you associate with comics.
Yeah.
And I think the problem is a lot of people still think of comics either as kid stuff or, oh, it's superheroes. And some of the best books, I mean, some of the books you and I love, even ones that come from the big two,
mm-hmm.
have nothing to do with superheroes.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we share a love of Transmetropolitan.
Transmetropolitan. And the other fun one, it's just within the last month, my wife finally picked up the Sandman series.
Right.
Tore through that. And she's like, so good. And I'm like, yeah, welcome to what introduced Neil Gaiman to the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, it took that huge step outside of here I come to save the day sort of superheroes that really made a difference.
And, you know, so Sandman, okay, here's the thing about Sandman. Since we're talking about pastiches and reinterpretations.
Yeah.
DC had a character named Sandman all the way back to the 1940s.
The guy in the gas mask and the fedora.
Yeah. And originally, Neil Gaiman Sandman was kind of riffing out of that. And even tied into that. But, you know, you can't keep a writer of Gaiman's caliber down.
Oh, no.
And even though they maintained the connection and created a great spinoff series called Sandman Mystery Theater, featuring the Wesley Dodd Sandman. Good writers are going to find ways to get their stuff out there, even if they have certain constraints.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, witness what Alan Moore did with Swamp Thing.
Witness what Alan Moore does, full stop.
Yeah, that's true. So,
which brings us back to the, nothing's wrong with a little trippy outside.
No,
out there.
That's true.
Yeah.
Anything on books recently you've been reading?
You know, the only thing I've been wading my way through is nonfiction. Cadillac Desert, which is a history of water in the West.
Water Knife is what inspired you to start reading that.
Yeah, and coming off of that. But it's a thick read, but it's fascinating to just see the amount of avarice and greed that made the Western United States. Fascinating stuff.
Oh, well, I've been a fan of just reading Seattle history.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of avarice and greed.
You want to talk about avarice and greed.
Yeah.
Sons of the Prophets.
Of course.
P-R-O-F-I-T-S.
Exactly.
For those of you playing at home. Is a fascinating history, and it basically shows that Seattle was birthed by a bunch of grifters and charlatans.
Yeah, pretty much everything west of about the 100th meridian can be said the same. So
yeah, I love the line in that book. You know, if they could have made money not creating Seattle, that's what would have happened.
Yeah.
So.
You reading besides Ghostlight?
Ghostlight, I've slowed down. I haven't had a lot of downtime to read. I'm still fully intending, once I finish Ghostlight, to dive into Sandman Slim. I just got a new Kindle, so that should facilitate reading a little bit more. E-readers, especially if you have to travel, they're a way to go.
You know, I just came back from 2 weeks in on the continent, and I still gladly schlepped the books around that I did. So.
Yeah.
But that's me.
Well, you know, the nice thing about books, you don't need to recharge them.
You don't need to recharge them, and people are like, but what happens if you drop it in the water? I'm like, what happens if you drop yours in the water?
this is a good point.
So.
Yeah. So with that, even though it's a little earlier than we normally do, I think we've pretty much run the course for... I think it's because we didn't have anything really bad to talk about this week.
You know, and that's a good thing.
You know, this is our Sunshine and Light episode where we talked angrily about...
Hydrocap.
Hydrocap and paranormal charlatans. So, all right, with that, thank you all for listening. If you want to get in touch with Daniel and I, we can be reached at www.fanboynewsnetwork.com. Just drop us a note in the comment section for the episode, and we'll be back in the relatively near future with more shenanigans.
Yay, shenanigans. Have a good 2 weeks, y'all.
This program is produced by Jeff Harris and Fanboy News Network. Is copyright 2016 to Jeff Harris and Fanboy News Network. All rights are reserved, including rights to copy and redistribute this program. All music in this podcast comes from the Footage Firm and is used under a royalty-free license.